with the Lord's word to him. And in the first part of this last section of the book of Revelation, we dealt with the judgment of the first enemy of the early church, which was the apostate church of Judaism, under the image of seven seals and then seven trumpets. The seals prefiguring the judgment, the trumpets bringing it to execution. Now we have entered the second part, the little book, and the vision that it gives us of the destruction, the conflict with and destruction of the second great enemy of the early church, which was, of course, pagan Rome. And we are right now entering the first part of this as we deal with these two beasts. And we have already shown that the first beast is indeed the Roman Empire, gathering into itself the symbolism clearly defined for us in the book of the prophet Daniel. And we have just seen how this great beast arises out of the sea and has the power to persecute the people of God. And John has just said that this calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. Well, now tonight we're going to look at the second beast, which we just read about, which arises out of the earth. Now, the sea probably denotes something far more vast in its extent than the land. And that may be the contrast between them. Although, if you'll turn back for a moment to Daniel chapter 7, you will see that there is not all that much difference between the one and the other. In Daniel chapter 7, where you have the four beasts of Daniel's vision described, in verse 4 we read, "The first was like a lion, it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off and it was lifted up from the ground," or the earth. And so it goes through that section. So that there is no great distinction, I think, between the sea and the land, except that probably the sea is vaster, denoting the entire Roman Empire. The land, not so vast, denoting, in my judgment, that portion of the Roman Empire which was adjacent to the prophet at the time that he wrote this. And you will notice that this second beast does not have the same dimensions. It doesn't have as many heads. They're not mentioned. And all that is mentioned is that it had two horns, but they are not the enormous horns of power in the same way that they are on the first beast, but these horns are rather like the horns of a lamb. At least they are resembling a lamb. And yet, this second beast speaks like a dragon, exercises all the authority of the first beast on his behalf, and was able to make the land, the earth, the portion of the world from which it has arisen, and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose fatal wound had been healed. Now, we already mentioned the fact that the fatal wound of the beast probably denoted the fact that Nero, the first great persecutor of the Christians, and therefore identified in everyone's mind at that time with the beast, killed himself by the sword. And indeed, in the time of John, there was a widespread fear and even belief that Nero would revive again, and therefore that the empire would still have this characteristic. Well, of course, Nero never did come back to life, but the beast doesn't represent an individual. The beast represents the empire. And even though, as you know, if you know your Roman history, it appeared at times that the empire would fall apart, it was revived indeed, and even became greater in its persecuting fury against the Christians than before, and largely because of the success of the cult of emperor worship, which I also mentioned the last time. So what you really have in this second beast is clearly defined for us in chapter 16, verse 13, and in a few other places. Here we read of the sixth bowl of wrath, and when that bowl of wrath was poured out, John says, I saw three evil spirits that looked like frogs. They came out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. They are spirits of demons performing miraculous signs, and they go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them for the battle of the great day. So the false prophet, if you look also in 19, verse 20, you have another reference where we read of the destruction there. We read that the beast was captured with him, the false prophet, who had performed the miraculous signs on his behalf. So already in the later part of the book of Revelation, the second beast is more commonly called just the false prophet. And we know that this is what is intended because in chapter 20, verse 4, these are the three. In verse 10, the devil was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur where the beast and the false prophet had been thrown. So these are the three great enemies of this portion of the book of Revelation, and they are working in concert the one with the other. The dragon animates the beast, and also the beast that supports the beast, in other words, the second beast, and the second beast is clearly a religious, as the first is clearly a civil power. And we can see this because of the things that he does. The second beast, to put it simply, fights the dragon's battles and does so by propping up and supporting and giving a long life to the first beast. And he does this by promoting the worship of the first beast. Now it says, he exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf and made the earth and its inhabitants, or the land and its inhabitants, worship the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed. And he performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of men. Because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. Now, if you look for a moment at Matthew 24 and at 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, I think you can clearly see an unmistakable line of connection between them. Jesus Christ is saying that in chapter 24 of Matthew, that in the time of the destruction of Jerusalem, the last days of the nation of Israel as a theocracy, verse 21, there will be great distress unequaled from the beginning of the world until now and never to be equaled again. And then he talks about false Christs and false prophets that perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect. Now in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, we read of the man of lawlessness who opposes and sets himself above all that is called God or worshipped by proclaiming himself to be God. That's in verse 4. We read then that he comes in verse 9 in accordance with the work of Satan, and that work of Satan is displayed in all kinds of counterfeit miracles, signs, and wonders, and in every sort of evil that deceives those who are perishing. So you have the characteristics of these carried right through this entire section. As you know, it is the great work of Satan to deceive the human race. As a matter of fact, one of the things that is ended in chapter 20 by the binding of Satan and casting him into the abyss is so that he will not be able to deceive the nations anymore until the 1,000 years were ended. That's in verse 3. Clearly then, the one main aim and purpose of the devil is to deceive the nations so that they don't understand the nature of God, they don't understand the real world in which they live, and of course they don't understand the nature of man. And so the way in which Satan is going to make war against the remnant of the seed of the woman, as we saw at the end of chapter 12, the way he's going to make war with her is to prop up the beast through this deception, this religious deception. And that religious deception is going to have its focus in requiring men to worship the first beast. And that, of course, is exactly what happened with the imperial worship, the cult of the emperor in the days of John. Here's what one commentator says. It is hardly possible to misunderstand the meaning. The Caesar worship was a state function, and the pagan priesthood wrought their signs before representatives of the empire. And the net effect of the work was to require and to bring all men to do obeisance to the image of the beast. Now, if you know the history of this period, you know that what was going on was that there was a rapid increase in the claims of the Caesars to be divine. We find even today in archaeological remains evidence that the Caesars actually demanded to be called God. And anyone who was not willing to ascribe to them divine names and honor was immediately branded as seditious, as in opposition to the state. And many times the Christians were put to the test by bringing them to an image of Caesar. Could be a statue usually, but could even be on a coin or something. And if they were willing to do obeisance to Caesar with unqualified assent to his supremacy, nothing befell them. If they were unwilling to do obeisance to Caesar because they maintained that Christ was above Caesar, then they were dispatched and put to death. And the thing that was going on in this period of the history of the Roman Empire was that through all these various mystery religions and pagan religions, because it was a variety in the Roman Empire, there was capitulation to this growing cult of the empire, so that the dominant religious factor in the lives of the people in Asia, where John wrote this letter, where the seven churches were, the dominant religious factor was the subservience of all religions, whatever they were, to the cult and supremacy of Caesar. And that was really the masterstroke of Satan, because the only religion that really was saw that as a life and death issue was the true Christian religion. The other religions had no great problem with that. They could ascribe dominion to Caesar and then maintain their religion. That is true today in the various religions of the world. Very few, other than the Christian religion, claim to be the only way to God and claim that Christ is supreme over nations, governments, and so on. Well, this then was the great issue that came to pass. And in this way, verse 15, he was given power, and that could be taken by God, or it could be by the devil. It could even be both. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast. The Roman Empire was, in other words, revived in its threatening attitude toward the people of God by the work of this second beast. He was revived and given life again in a persecuting way. And as you know, there were 10 great persecutions against the Christians growing out of this demand for the worship of the empire. And so he was able to cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed. And it didn't matter what your rank was, if you were a senator in the Roman Senate, or if you were a lowly Christian out there in Asia Minor, didn't make any difference. Rich, poor, slave or free, you had to receive the mark of the beast, which means that you had to have complete subservience to imperial Rome as the supreme unifying fact of your existence on both your forehead and your right hand, which is symbolic of your world outlook had to be the supremacy of Caesar and of Rome. And your daily deeds had to be in accordance with that supremacy. It doesn't mean a literal mark on somebody's right hand or forehead any more than back in the book of Deuteronomy, where Moses said you are to put the law's frontlets to your eyes. It doesn't mean that you literally put these things horses used to wear on so you can't see out sideways, but it meant that the law of God was so all-controlling that you saw nothing out of the context of the law of God. And I pointed out the parallel there between that and the Old Testament. So the result was that you either submitted to this unifying, dominant Caesar cult, or you were very literally in great straits, because you couldn't even buy or sell without the mark of the beast. And for many Christians, it really did come down to that. Some had to flee, and it was a very difficult existence for Christians in that period of history. So what you really have is this dominance of the religion of the Roman Empire, which was really not a religion in the sense that we might think of it, but it was a virtual deification of the values and principles of the Roman Empire imposed on people as supreme. And one can't help but feel the parallels to our existence today. Of all the nations of the world that I know anything about in my study of history, probably no nation of the world has been as far away from that picture there in Revelation 13, 11 to 18 as the United States. And that is because in its formative period, the principles of the Bible were very much felt in the Constitution and the like. But the problem today is that this is being eroded. And in place of what we might call the idea of a transcendent law, a law that transcends the government and rulers of the nation, there is now what we call humanist law in this country. Now, let me give you an example. In October, one of the Supreme Court justices, William J. Brennan, Jr., gave an address that really reveals how far we have come. When our Constitution was written, you will remember that it speaks of things like inalienable rights with which we are endowed by our Creator. Now, what does that mean? Inalienable rights with which we are endowed by our Creator. Well, it means there are some things that governments are not allowed to touch, and those rights come from God and must be respected. And so the idea was, we'll write a constitution and we'll enshrine that in the constitution, and that constitution will be the supreme law of the land. Not men in any department of government, but that constitution. Well, now Brennan says, we have to get away from this. The constitution is what the judges say it is. Those who would restrict claims of right, he says, to the values of 1789, turn a blind eye to social progress. The Constitution, he says, does not rest in any static meaning it might have had in a world that is dead and gone. One of the Supreme Court justices said the Constitution means whatever the judges say it means. Now, when I was in Washington some months ago, I went to the Jefferson Memorial and I saw these words: God, who gave us life, gave us liberty. Can the liberties of a nation be secure when we have removed a conviction that these liberties are the gift of God? Well, the answer is you can't. And the result is that today there is a constant erosion of this idea of transcendent law to the point of a humanistically imposed solution. And I believe that the results are going to be more and more like the book of Revelation says. It has come to the place where you cannot do things without the imprimatur of the government. Your religion is more and more excluded from vast areas of life. I know when I was in high school, you could have the Ten Commandments on the wall of the high school, and nobody ever thought anything about it, because we were living in a culture that was still predominantly influenced by biblical Christianity. And a teacher did not have to keep silent if they believed that this universe was divinely created and the like. Well, now you see what is relentlessly happening in the whole fabric of our country is that this is being excluded. And the one who is supreme over conscience in many areas of life is not allowed anymore to be Jesus Christ, but is required to be the state. The state can tell you whether or not you can pray. The state can tell you whether or not you can refer to the Creator, and so on. I read an interesting article in the Presbyterian Journal today, and it was a study made by two scholars of the school textbooks on history of America and social studies. And it had quite a lot in there about the religion of the American Indians. These books, these textbooks did. But these scholars found out to their utter amazement that there's not a word in there about the predominant religion of historical America, which has been the Protestant faith. That evidently can't be mentioned anymore. And even in dealing with the pilgrims, they mentioned that the pilgrims felt thankful and therefore decided to have thanksgiving. But they could not mention God to whom they gave thanks, you see. Now that is what is actually taking place. This is not a radical paper. I'm talking about the Presbyterian Journal of a less militant church than our own, the Presbyterian Church of America. And the reason for this is the insistence of the state that its humanistic, secular outlook be accepted by everyone in wider and wider areas of life. And that was exactly what was taking place back there in the early church, in the Roman Empire. As long as you were willing to acknowledge the supremacy of the state over your private faith, then you could have your private faith. But if you dared to say that your private faith could even sit in judgment on the state, then you see, your life was in danger. And frankly, it's not so terribly far from that in principle today. Now, I maintain that, I know it's easy for me to say, but I maintain that a public school teacher should teach creationism. If they get fired, too bad. But that's what they should teach, because number one, it's true, and number two, our Constitution says we are endowed with rights by our Creator, and the state can't take them away from us. And students at the school up here should pray, whether or not the Supreme Court says they can. I know that I am standing with the fathers of our country when I say that. And the fact that the present rulers of our society are humanistic and anti-Christian and say you can't do that doesn't change that for a moment. Christian people should assert their fidelity to Jesus Christ in these spheres. And indeed, thank God, they are in many of these areas, especially, as I've mentioned before, in the Christian school movement of our country. But what you really had here then in the Roman Empire was a religious ideology stamped on the forehead and right hand of every citizen of the Roman Empire, which in effect told him he could buy and sell only if he was willing to be subservient to the beast. That was what the devil was going to use and did use to prop up the Roman Empire and keep it alive as the ferocious beast desiring to devour God's people. See, the beast had failed when, in collusion with the false church, it had killed the Messiah because the Messiah rose from the dead. And the dragon, you remember, was angry. He had failed. And he was so angry, he went out to make war with the remnant. That's the end of chapter 12. And here, to keep that going, Satan has to increase the totalitarian power of the Roman Empire through this false religious ideology. And I believe then that that is quite clearly the meaning of this portion. Most likely the reference here to the image of the beast is the use of some likeness or image of Caesar before which the Christians had to bow to show their obeisance. And the concluding thing there in verse 18, this calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is man's number. His number is 666. As I pointed out, that is numerically something that fits the name of Caesar. But again, I rather doubt that it is, I mean the name of Nero. I doubt again that it is one individual. I think rather, as is characteristic through the book of Revelation, it is a corporate ideal, and it is the number of man. Not just that he falls short of the seven by being six, but that it is six multiplied. In other words, this is humanistic society. So it's a society in which man is supreme, in which man deifies himself, pushed to the nth degree. And so I believe that in saying it is man's number, that's the idea. It is the deification of man. And in place of the seven, threefold seven, which would be indicative of the true God and of his works, it's the threefold repetition of the number that falls short of God, the humanistic number. And there's plenty in the book of Revelation to indicate how much the church had to conflict with this sort of thing. Now, I don't know if you have any questions thus far. Are there any questions from anyone? Yes, it is. It is. But like all things in the Bible that are past history, it does have abiding relevance. See, that's the genius of the Bible, is the fact that it is rooted in history. You never quite repeat history exactly again, but in all of the historical portions of the New Testament, principles are revealed in such a way that we can then even more clearly see them when we are confronted by the same thing ourselves. But in answer to your question, is this past history? Indeed it is. It is past history.
I'd like to ask is, you hear, or I have heard in the past, that 666 is the number of the Antichrist. Now,
well, as I...
666, where did they get...
Well, first of all, to identify 666 with the Antichrist is a pure assumption. The last time we were together, I dealt briefly with that, but if you remember back there in 1st and 2nd John, it is clearly stated that the Antichrist is not future, but present. Not one, but many. Not Superman, but supernatural spirit.
But it's the 666 I'm talking about.
Yes, but you said Antichrist. Now, first of all, then, there is no basis at all for identifying the Antichrist with this text. The second thing is to identify this with a particular man that is yet future is, in my opinion, to contradict the symbolic character of the book. Just as there is no literal lamb like this and no literal beast like this, I mean a beast that is actually a four-footed creature, so there is no one man like this either. It is, and you can see that from verse 18, because it says this, if anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast. In other words, it's not just the number of man, but also of beast. And the beast is not an individual. The beast is a corporate entity. The beast, if we have correctly interpreted this, is either the first or the second beast. I believe here he's talking of the first beast, because the second beast has propped the first beast up so that everyone to buy and sell had to receive the mark of that beast. In other words, the one whose image had to be bowed down to and whose mark had to be received was the Imperial Roman Empire. And that is what the number stands for. To say then that it is man's number indicates, in my judgment, that it is the deification of man which lies at the root of all this. And I believe that that is why it is 666. Because nothing comes so close to God in pretension and even in being as man, because man is made in the image of God. But however much man may try to rise to divine level, or to deity, let us say, he falls short. And so it is six, and not just six, but six three times. So it seems to me that that has to be the meaning. And I believe that that is also in perfect agreement with, and this is always important because we compare Scripture with Scripture, it is very clearly in line with 2 Thessalonians 2. For the man of sin there also represents more than just an individual. For his coming is by the secret power of lawlessness, which is already at work. And there again you have the present nature of it. And you have the counterfeit miracles. And you have those who are deceived. And this man of lawlessness is revealed. And he opposes himself against everything that is God or called God or worshipped, so that he puts himself up as supreme. It seems to me that can only be some man representing the Roman Empire in its imperial power who does that. And as I pointed out to you, I believe that that's none other than Titus, who actually did come in and sit down in the temple of God, asserting the supremacy of Caesar over Jehovah. Any other question at all? Okay, well, just to look forward, we go on then in chapter 14 here to see Christ on Mount Zion with his followers. And we'll just, by way of anticipation, note a couple of things here. Then I looked, and there before me was the Lamb. In contrast to the one who had horns like a lamb is the real Lamb, standing on Mount Zion, not on the earth, but in heaven. With him 144,000 who had his name and his Father's name written on their foreheads. So these are the ones who refuse to submit to the forehead marking of the beast, and they insist upon the forehead marking of Christ, meaning that their world and life view asserts the supremacy of Christ, and they are definitely going to be triumphant and victorious. And then he hears the sound from heaven like a roar of rushing water, the peal of thunder, the sound of harpists playing with their harps, and they sing a new song, and so on. It is clearly the triumphant song of those who have victory over the two beasts and the dragon, and victory in terms of the conflict in the Roman Empire. And he says, verse 4, these are those who did not defile themselves with women, for they kept themselves pure. They follow the Lamb wherever he goes. I'll have reason when we come back next time to explain that. Again, not very complimentary to women if you take it literally. But if you take it symbolically as we should, you'll find the answer to that back in the book of Proverbs, the book of wisdom, where God's wisdom is the beautiful woman with which one should associate, and the false, devilish wisdom of this world is the harlot woman with which one should have nothing to do. And that is what it's talking about. But we'll come back to that in our fellowship next time.